Hi, everyone. I'm Brian Kiley.
I'm Josh Ute.
I'm Judah Sanders.
And this is Engaging Culture, a podcast presented by Bridgeway Christian Church. We are nearing the end of 2025, and that means the Oxford Dictionary, Cambridge Dictionary, and Dictionary.com have released their words of the year. We're going to look at what they are and what they tell us about society. And is anti-intellectual Christianity rising in the digital age, and why should we care about it if it is? That's what we're talking about on this episode of Engaging Culture. All right, we are back after a week off. I give that intro a C+. It was going along pretty solid, but I kind of lost it at the end, but we're not doing a second take. Josh and Judah, you're here.
And we are.
We are.
Happy. So very happy.
As usual, the ray of sunshine in my life that you are, Josh. Yes. Tell us, what is the best thing you saw this week?
So I will leave out the Thanksgiving stories because that's too easy. But the best thing is we took the family to a Kings game on Monday of Thanksgiving week. And one, texting back and forth with Pastor Brian, who was there, it was an epic text exchange.
An absolute delight.
And it really made 99% of that game watchable because the game was so awful. But in the last 3 minutes, the Kings start making this comeback, and watching not my kids get into it, but my wife standing up and screaming.
Stand on business, Joanna.
Basket.
Stand on business.
She was losing her mind.
That's right.
Having the best time. She got so into those last 3 minutes. And I don't think she talked about that game once during the other, 46 minutes, 42 minutes. And it was so funny. And it was just so much joy. And then the Kings end up winning. The kids have a great experience. We sat literally in the last seats in the very, very top. Our backs are against the wall. That's what I get for the discount tickets.
There we go. Yes, that was a very fun night. And just to briefly, my perspective on this, we were also sitting up very high, Matthew and I, but because we were there with his school basketball teammates, and they were sitting a few rows away from us. And I said to Matthew, I'm like, hey, go sit with your teammates. Like, it's fine. I'll be fine. So I'm literally sitting there, third row of the top Golden 1 Center, watching this game by myself, watching Monday Night Football during the timeout, texting with Josh like we're a couple of grumpy old men about how like lousy our team is. And then at the end, our text thread has this like crazy turn where we're like, oh my gosh, what just happened? Wow, we won.
Yeah.
It was very funny. So Judah, best thing you saw.
I'm going to cheat and do two. Number one, Christianity Today just appointed Dr. Nicole Martin as CEO and president. I've been a big fan of hers for a long time. She's just quite an incredible leader. And it's kind of beautiful, the evolution of Christianity Today from being the platform that Billy Graham founded to where it is today. So just excited for her and excited for what that means that publication. Second, I was in the Netherlands last week and I went to the Anne Frank House.
Ooh.
Wow. And it was a wild experience. The place where she was hiding.
Yeah.
And you have to like crawl through the actual hole in the wall and the bookshelf. And they really make it an immersive experience where they really push you to be quiet. You know, you don't want anybody to hear. And so, like, you have to take turns going to the bathroom because the water and the pipes could make noise and, you know, alert people that you're up there. But I think the thing that was most profound to me was just that, because, you know, I read it in high school. It was a part of the curriculum. And just realizing she was a brilliant writer at 14, a brilliant writer. And just kind of the additional grief, in addition to like the loss of life and the reason why she lost her life. If you don't know, she was a victim of the Holocaust. We don't know like what kind of literature we lost because she was not allowed to grow up and grow and become even better. And I was just really thinking a lot about how hate takes a toll really on like the whole society, not just like on the family, not just on the targeted group, not just on the victims, but really on the culture and the society, and we don't know what good literature would have come out of that little girl. So anyway, those are the two. But I guess the Anne Frank house saying best thing is probably a little complicated, but one of the more impactful things.
I mean, what an extraordinary thing to get to see that space in person. Mm. That's amazing. Yeah. That's amazing. All right. Yeah. Right on. My best thing, as usual, not as deep as yours, on Friday of Thanksgiving week, we surprised our kids and took them to see Trans-Siberian Orchestra, which they're both in band, so they had expressed that they would love to see them. I don't know that they knew that they were in town, and just totally messed with them. Like, I had told them, hey, Friday night, we're doing a family fun activity. And, you know, of course, Joey's worried I'm going to take him on some, like, Death March hike or something. And he's like, do you promise it's going to be fun? And I think it's going to be fun. I think it's going to be great.
That baby was stressed
and
all
then, like, we got in the car. And, you know, Joey's like, ah, great. And, you know, we get in the car, and I set the GPS to, like, Seattle. which, funny, they instantly just started laughing. They just thought that was hilarious. And I, like, drove us to a different parking lot than we normally park at when we go to Golden One Center, but it was the parking lot we park in if we go to A's games. So, okay. And it's also right by the train museum. Right. So they're like, this better not be the train museum. And then, you know, we get out of the car. Yeah. Matthew's like, is this anything to do with the A's? No. Is it anything to do with the Kings? Well, the Kings are currently playing in Utah. They're in the second quarter. So no. And they're like, oh gosh, what? And, you know, we walk a different way than we normally do to get to Golden One Center. And finally we get up there. They're even inside of the arena. And then it like comes up on the marquee. And Matthew's like, Trans-Siberian Orchestra? Right. Yeah. Like, oh, cool. They start texting their little band friends. And
that's
anyway.
Cool.
And, you know, I'll be honest, the concert got off to a little bit of a slow start. I'm like, I don't know, how's this going to go? But it was great. Super fun. Pyrotechnics are crazy. And, you know, they haven't changed much in the 25 years.
Hey,
since,
if it ain't broke, why fix it?
You know, and literally, fun fact, Christy and I, our very first date was a fraternity date event to see Trans-Siberian Orchestra almost 25 years
ago.
Nice
full circle moment.
That was fun. So anyway, super fun. It was great. I don't know that I need to see them again, but they are great to see about once every quarter century. We had a blast. We'll be right back.
Every year, dictionary organizations choose a word of the year. But why does it matter is the real question for us today. So we're going to look at three different words of the year from Oxford, Cambridge, and dictionary.com. And we're going to start with the dumbest of them. But a little bit background of how they choose that. So Oxford uses language data plus public voting. And the way that it works is that they have different experts on their teams who go through most searched words or most used words within the public spaces. They put them up, people vote on them, and then they have linguists go through about which words have the most cultural shape to them.
I'm glad you explained that, because I was like, I ain't vote for nothing. Right. No, but I ain't get my ballot in the mail.
And then Cambridge tracks statistics and uses a little bit of a different approach to that. And then dictionary.com is pretty much what is the most looked up phrase on their website. And that's really it. But that is how they choose the words. And so we're going to start with dictionary.com. And dictionaries.com is the word 6-7.
I hate it.
I'm protesting in silence.
So, fellas, can you tell me the origin of 6-7?
The children.
Here's what's wild to me about 6-7 is, and I'm very sorry if you're listening to this with your children who have now lost their minds. I'm very sorry.
Hey, babies. Hope you have a good day at school.
What astonishes me about it is there is so much content in the world. And my understanding is it was some YouTube personality, some gamer, whatever. I don't know the details. I should have looked it up. Where he just like started, like he said 6-7 in this weird intonation. And like somehow that catches fire.
Yeah.
And it's like this virus that immediately spreads to all children everywhere. There's so much other content, so many other dumb things that are said that just disappear into the universe. And yet, I mean, there were articles in the Wall Street Journal, like The Wall Street Journal about how this is creating problems for math teachers.
Oh, absolutely.
It's crazy.
You know why I can't give it too much, though, is because I'm a millennial, and I remember when bootylicious became a word in the dictionary.
I'm sorry, what now?
Yeah. It's like a real thing.
I believe Destiny's Child coined that term.
And it's like in the dictionary, and it was like a big thing. And so I feel like every generation has their kind of embarrassing word moment.
True.
Absolutely.
That is absolutely correct. However,
bootylicious actually has something that it's describing. 6'7" is literally just the word 6'7" said in that way. And so what people are referring it to is that it's digital slang representing in-group signaling, meaning I know what this is, and so let's have a conversation. Like, I'm cool too, just because I'm using this phrase 6'7". But yes, my sister-in-law is a teacher in the fourth grade, and all of their page numbers have to go backwards, because if you go sequentially 6'7", the class is completely unworkable for the next 10 minutes. And
that's
so
hilarious.
She's like, so we'll be on pages 8, 7, and 6. Like, just,
she should not have to think about that.
Well, and see, and that is the difference between bootylicious, which is a fairly easy term to avoid for me anyway, in my regular language.
Well,
Once again, obviously
didn't go to school in Long Beach because
clearly. But we're talking about, you know, like, we're playing video games at home, and we play sports video games in our house, which involve lots of numbers. And it's, you know, I got my kid freaking out when he, like, we finally, like, we banned it in our home. I said, if you have a reaction to it, your phone is mine for the rest of the day. Like, we're just done. I'm just tired of it. And now here's the thing. There is an innocence to it that I don't want to totally grumpy old man this. Whatever. Kids are having fun. It's a slant. Like, to your point about other words, we all do it. But it is just fascinating to me how disruptive it has become. And I've heard lots of stories like the ones you just shared about it interfering with, you know, basic schooling.
Yeah. So my daughter's middle school, before the fall break came, they had a memorial service. 4, 6, 7.
That's wild business.
So they had,
that's a waste of taxpayer funding.
No, it works. It is a great use of taxpayer.
So what ended up happening?
Why didn't call me to do the eulogy? I would have done it.
They did a pep rally essentially, and all the teachers came out in all black.
That's funny.
And buried 6, 7. And one of the things that they promise to do is that they are now out 6-7-ing the kids and making it so cringe.
Love that.
They're just leaning in and like 6-7.
So
like
the faculty's doing it. Oh, yeah.
Like over and over to the point where the kids are getting incredibly annoyed.
Yeah.
And so it is slowly dying within her middle school.
That reminds me of the episode of Saved by the Bell where half the gang was selling like friendship bracelets and the other half was selling like headbands and they called them buddy bands. And the bracelet group tried to undermine the headband group, stay with me here, by giving a buddy band to the principal, and then he wore it. And everyone's like, well, if he's wearing it, it's cool.
All done.
And I've had that thought of like, maybe just, parents, teachers, whatever, we just need to lean in hard. And the kids are like, all right, well, if the grown-ups are into
it, don't think
it's not cool.
Needs all this strategy. I think go home and tell your children, if you say it again, it's going to be me and you, and mostly me. We'll shut this thing down real quick.
As mandatory reporters, we're going to go ahead and say that you don't have kids and let people know we don't actually have to report you. But what I think is really interesting is about what this says about our culture. One of the really interesting things in our day and age is that there's very few shared experiences.
Yeah, that's true.
So when we were growing up, Brian and I, Judah was probably still too young to remember this.
Yes.
You know,
many
the pre-streaming age.
Many years ago.
This man was praying for me yesterday, by the way.
For his life.
Which
was
very kind.
In the spirit. You're
but
welcome.
He used the phrase at his age.
I was interceding for his very life.
He's
going to run a marathon.
43, not 107.
And at 53, he has no business going to do a marathon.
Back to what you were saying, Josh.
Back to me. So when we were growing up, there was the Thursday night television. Like, that was prime spot.
Yep.
People watched Seinfeld all at the same time. the next day, if you didn't see that episode in real time, you were lost in the culture. So it became this cultural touch point that, you know, the water cooler story type of deal where everybody's coming together. Well, those don't really exist anymore in a lot of ways. It's not even in sports. It's not in really any area of life that we have these cultural moments that especially our youth can attach to have the shared experience.
Yeah.
And so when moments like this happen, it's actually a giant community indicator, which is odd, but it's this giant thing of like, oh, we have a shared experience that we can now be, we are all together in that.
No, you're,
well, we
you're
all shared the pandemic. That was a shared experience.
But, and that just goes back to my original point, though, of like, of all the things, because you're right. There is, we are no longer living in an era where you can come in the day after a show and expect that your colleagues or your friends or your neighbors have all seen it. Like, that era has passed. There's maybe the Super Bowl, and that's about it. And this breaks through the noise. The power of something to break through the noise and becoming something that everyone knows about. It's wild.
Yeah, and the crazy thing is nobody can monetize this.
People are trying.
I'm sure.
Oh, well, there were 6-7 Halloween costumes.
Oh, I bet there were. But all it takes is a T-shirt and a Sharpie, and you have two people going as a couple, 6 and 7. All right. Now we're going to move on to something that's a little bit more.
Now that we've done the highbrow stuff.
let's really drag the bottom to society. Then the one that came out of Oxford's dictionary was the phrase rage bait. And this is content crafted to provoke outrage online. It is driven it's content that's driven for clicks and eyeballs. And it's not about conveying true information or really any information. The point is not to even convince anybody of anything. It's just to get them to click the article. And the reality is, people read what scares them and they read what angers them more often than what pleases them and what calms them.
They don't even read it. They watch it. Yeah. I could take it if they read it.
Yeah. Yeah. So
they click it.
So for you guys, when you hear the phrase rage bait, what does that bring up for you?
I think it's really tragic on a few different levels. Number one, that we in so many segments of society glory in causing offense. That is a moral tragedy to me. That we would delight in offending another person. Now, that doesn't mean we need to not have convictions that might be offensive. But the idea that I would rejoice in that what I'm saying is offensive to somebody is just a really childish way to view the world. And you see this in politics, you see this in sports, you see this in entertainment, that just this sense of I want to cause you harm or bother you with what I'm saying.
Right.
Again, some things may be bothersome, but the point isn't to bother. Maybe the point is to persuade, the point is to, you know, whatever. But this idea of going, I am producing content just to upset you is very troubling to me. And then secondarily, that kind of, you mentioned this in the introduction to this word, Josh, this idea of going, it's actually not even about the fact that I'm harming you emotionally. It's that I'm leveraging emotional harm for the purpose of gaining attention, money, clicks, advertising dollars. Right. The whole thing is just really gross to
sick.
Me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it speaks to a very natural human inclination to be drawn to anger. And I think that's why, you know, in the early teens of Proverbs, you know, you see all these scriptures about being slow to anger and managing your anger, and that fast anger is folly and foolish, like over and over again for like 10 chapters, like 14, like to like 21 or something like that. You see all these scriptures, and I think that it's because God knew that this was going to be our thing, that this was going to be our attraction. And I think the thing that we have to be careful about is that it's something that we're all susceptible to, right? Like, this is not a them over there issue. It's a like me issue. It's a let me really like be careful and have like guardrails and boundaries about what I'm consuming. And then I think to notice the anger, because I think we get angry and don't notice that we're angry because we're not punching holes in walls quite yet. And we're not screaming and cursing, perhaps. I think, you know, when I think about like the average believer, they're probably not doing that, but can still be just ingesting a ton of anger and then stoking it. And then I wonder how that micro bleeds onto, you know, your family and your workspace and kind of these other areas of your life. So,
yeah. What do you think, Josh?
I think it's really an interesting idea that we are so drawn to the anger parts, because I'm trying to think of like anthropologically why that would be an innate desire, because it seems to be pretty universal. Like, it's not just, oh, this is just American culture that does this. It's pretty much everywhere. And so I think there's like a survival mechanism that gets kicked in, the fight or flight pieces. As a community, we rise up against our enemy to protect one another, like that kind of village mentality.
Yeah.
And I think it's important for us to recognize that we have this impulse, because those who are providing this kind of media, they recognize it.
Yeah.
They know that we have that. That's why they're leveraging it. And to remind ourselves that information is not the point for most publications today, in today's world. And some of that is just reality of they have to pay people and they have to figure out how to pay people. And this is the way to do that. And to remember that we are customers. We're not buddies.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of us will tend to treat those that we have media connection with as our buddy who's just trying to help us stay informed, when they're not trying to help us stay informed. They're trying to get our financial benefit for the most part.
Right.
And that's a really gross place to be, and obviously that's an incredibly uncharitable way to view that. And I don't mean that everybody is just a money grubber, blah blah blah, but those who are making the editorial decisions of what gets posted, what doesn't get posted, how it gets posted, all of that, they have real bottom lines, and we are a customer base, and so that should inform the way that we should treat media. With a little bit of cynicism, not complete like rejection of everything, but just being sober minded, as the scripture says, like trying to take things a little bit slow. Recognize, especially if they're tapping into emotional responses, like the moment it is that should be the pump the brakes and let's read through, make sure we understand.
Inflammatory language that's supposed to put, like, you could just say A happened and B happened, but when you're like, you know, when you use language that is supposed to pull on my emotions, it makes me ask questions about what are your interests.
Right. Well, and I've said this before. You look at the difference between a Fox News headline, a Huffington Post headline, a New York Times headline, and a Wall Street Journal headline.
Right.
Fox News and Huffington Post are incredibly biased, like far right, far left, whatever. Wall Street Journal and New York Times, Wall Street Journal is more right, New York Times is more left. So I'm not trying to say they're dead center, but they're like respected, legitimate, you know. Whereas you look at a Huffington Post is worse than Fox in this regard, but just like it's constant inflammatory stuff all the time. And if you're getting that, then that's probably a good sign that, like, hey, you need to be careful with this news source. To know that, like, they're really leaning into that, like, animal brain, fire you up, get you afraid kind of mentality. And also just recognize we crave rage for the same reason we crave sugar, because our bodies and brains change slower than society does. We crave sugar because 1,000 years ago and less, resources were scarce, and you needed to eat as much calorie dense food as you needed to. So everyone who didn't like to eat calorie dense food died. So that's how genetics works, folks. Like, that's just how it worked. In the same way, threats for the majority of human history were like legit life and death threats.
Right.
So we pay attention to the negative. We pay attention to what could harm us. But the problem is we have that same physiological response to news we don't like that our ancestors might have had to a tiger hiding in the bushes, which are very different things. So we just have to be mindful of that.
Yeah, I think the other piece about the rage bait conversation is How much do we contribute to that within our own circles? And so, yes, yeah. I don't make media content. Like, nobody's paying me to do that. But I do have conversations with folks in the backyard. I do have, you know, friendships, and we have, you know, back and forth with family, whatever that might be. And how much of that are we leaning into the look at how angry we all should be?
Yeah.
And I see that a lot, especially within Christian circles right now, of there's things for us to get angry about with the culture around us, that we're in these culture wars and whatever that is. Like, we have to take these strong stands, and it doesn't become about the scripture nearly as much for a lot of people. For some, it is. Let me not paint too broad of a brush here, but where a lot of the discussion is about us being together against the evil of this world.
Yeah.
Which, you know, is rooted in a decent place heart-wise, but reality becomes Jesus gave us a much better way to live. He gave us a being meek. He gave us being humble. He gave us a serving others. He gave us a community-based mindset that wasn't purely against the Romans. And I think right now what we have a lot in Christian circles is us against the world. And so we're going to rage against the world, and we're going to fight aggression with aggression.
Yeah. And that exists not because it's an accurate reflection of reality. Right. It exists because even within the Christian world, there is so much media designed to make us afraid of the world, to give us, I mean, the need for evangelicals to have a victim and martyr complex is wild to me. And how often I'm in conversations about, like, oh, how terrible the world is and everything else. And I'm just like, stop. Like, I had a conversation with a guy yesterday talking about how he's afraid of this, that, and the other. And I said, bro, whatever you are listening to that is telling you that, like, seriously, stop. You are being lied to. Like, that is a ridiculous, and this is someone I have a lot of relational capital with. I'm like, is not something you need to be afraid of. You're afraid of it because people who have an incentive to make you afraid keep telling it to you. And I think as believers, if anything, we should be the most positive about how things are in the world, because we know that God is still on the throne, that the Holy Spirit is still at work. And this idea of going, oh, we just need to fight, we just need to begin, like, it is worldly, and it is not helpful, and I'll get off my soapbox now.
Yeah, and I do, like, and that doesn't mean that we're Pollyanna and we ignore the problems of the world. We can still be active in dealing with the problems of the world, but it's keeping that balance of perspective that says, there is a lot of growth that we still need to experience.
Yeah, absolutely.
But we can also rejoice in where things currently are in comparison.
And, like, have hope.
And have hope,
you know. Yeah, and, like, running water and Wi-Fi is really awesome. Like, I'd rather live now than any other time. Anyway, what's our third word?
Our third word comes out of the Cambridge Dictionary, and it's the word parasocial. This is a one-sided emotional connection to influencers, TV characters, actors, people that we don't actually know, but we feel like we have a personal relationship with. And it's now creeping into the AI space with these AI companions. And as weird as it sounds, I think it says something about our society that we have these deep emotional connections with people we've never met. And it's really interesting. And this is not unique to current society. I mean, we've had this forever, especially with actors. Like, that has been, like, an actor dies and people mourn as if, it was their actual grandma. It's like, you've never met them. You know, you can be sad, but you can still go to work. You don't need to take bereavement leave. And so it's that kind of a thing. Like, why do you think that is? Why are we so drawn to these personalities or fake personalities that we see online or we see in different spaces? Why do you think we're so drawn to that we have that emotional connection?
You know, I don't know. I really don't. I don't understand it. I have experienced the harm that comes with that, and I don't get it. I think maybe it's because humans are prone to idolatry. Mm. I think that people are lonely. And I think that, you know, if I watch you on whatever platform every single day, especially with the amount of time that people spend on social media and consuming media, I think that you can probably conflate that with like real connection and real relationship. And also when you're consuming somebody online, you're allowed to, you know, our biases fill in holes and mm-hmm. gaps. And watching somebody online, there's a ton of holes and gaps about that person that I think our biases fill in. And so, like, you know, I know that in my own life, I've been frustrated when I find out that this celebrity or that celebrity or this person that I consume has a position or did a thing that I didn't agree with or that I wouldn't expect them to do. And it's in that moment that you have to say, yeah, but you actually didn't know them. And so I don't know right. why you're like, yeah. oh, how could they? Or be right. so surprised. So
yeah. No, I think that's right. And there are just so many opportunities for these types of relationships today, social media, right. YouTube, whatever. And I think there is something attractive about access, especially access to interesting people. So many interesting people are spending a lot of their time in front of a cell phone or computer screen. Hey, guys, how's it going? Yeah. Whatever, that kind of thing. So there's all these opportunities to feel connected, and it requires no vulnerability. So I feel connected to a famous and important person, which feels good for my ego and everything else. And it is not requiring any sort of relational skills on my part. So I think, you know, you alluded to this. This has existed forever. And it's so funny. I'm tempted to like completely hate on it. But I think there's an element that's just sort of very normal. Like you engage with someone's content. And you feel like you know them. I've had people say that to me. Oh, I've listened to your sermons. I feel like I know you. I'm reading a book for a guest we're going to have on next week. And it's like, I kind of feel like I know her now. I don't. We've never met. But so I think that sense of familiarity goes with the territory. Where it becomes problematic is where it becomes a replacement for actual social stuff. Like, you are not part of an online community because you all watch the same videos of the same celebrity. Like, you're a part of an audience. And an audience and a community is very different. And when we settle for just being an audience in these parasocial settings and don't have the actual give and take of human relationships, that's where it gets to be that's where we get ourselves in trouble. And it's just so risky because, again, it's so easy. Yeah. To have a parasocial relationship 30 years ago was very limited and very, like, it took a lot of work, frankly.
Right.
Now, actual relationships are a lot of work, and the parasocial stuff is easy.
Yeah, I look at how people respond to different celebrity news. You know, celebrity death is one thing because that's dealing with the realities of life, and that can be jarring for everyone.
Yeah.
No matter what your relationship is, just knowing that somebody is no longer there is different. But when you look at the people crying with joy because Taylor Swift got engaged, thought, you know, and even she made a comment using parasocial pieces of like, they feel like they're a part of this and they're a part of this relationship when they don't know anything about us.
Yep.
And I thought that was just a really insightful thing for her to say, in regards to, yes, there is a fan base that has this really deep connection with the art that she makes. And so they have this emotional connection to what she does. Yeah. Which then gives them that, as you were saying, that illusion of relationship.
Yeah.
And I begin to wonder, what is it within the church that we aren't providing, that we could be providing, that would help lessen the draw of this, especially for our young folks? Yeah. Of like, how do we provide community in such a space that you don't have, you're not even hungry for that meal?
I think it's tough to eliminate it completely, but I think that you can make sure that church is not primarily a parasocial space, that it is not primarily a place where your identification with that community is just the pastor or just the leader or just the people you see on stage. And it's incumbent upon us as leaders of this community and also members of this community to go, okay, are we setting up systems where it's actually social, not parasocial? Mm-hmm. And then are all of us, leaders and lay people, are we all leaning in a way where we're valuing real relationships and not allowing this to become a parasocial space where we get teaching and music and head home? So I think there's kind of
everyone for a larger church than a smaller
it
church.
It is. Mm-hmm. I think so.
Yeah, and I think one of the struggles that we have right now for us as a church is getting people into these intentional communities spaces, whether that's community groups or volunteering and serving and being a part of what's going on with the church as a whole. What's really interesting right now is that we're dealing with some volunteer crises of not having enough volunteers to manage, like KidsWay, for example.
Yeah.
Just our normal weekend, we are severely understaffed. What's interesting is that our church attendance numbers are climbing, but our volunteerism numbers are declining. So it's trying to figure out where are we in our spectrum with us as a mature community that sees the value in serving one another.
Yeah.
And what can we be doing as leadership to help cultivate that? Because it's always a little bit weird of, hey, come work for free for us. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But we're seeing this issue. And what it says is that, to me, it says that we have a lot of parasocial connection to Bridgeway, and that's climbing, and that's on the rise. But the true connection between people within community groups, within serving groups, is not there. So we want to see, how do we really change that around so that people have real relationships?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Words of the year, they're a mirror of our culture. That's 100%. what it does. And just take some time, think about it. I'd also encourage you to figure out if you were going to have a word of your year for 2025, other than the word disappointment, Brian.
None of mine.
Whatever.
You're running a marathon.
Excitement.
At 107.
Bad
it's really amazing. Your hips will always...
Wait for next week. Then it'll be disappointment. I'll be dealing with the aftermath of this nonsense.
No, but take a reflection back as we're closing out 2025. And how would you define your year? And then what do you want your life to be defined by next year?
All right, we'll be right back. Well, we are back, and there was an article that caught my attention about a week and a half ago. I actually heard about it on another podcast, but immediately went and read it. And the headline is Anti-Intellectual Christianity's Rise in the Digital Age. And it's from Juicy Ecumenicism. Say
love
that three
name.
Times fast.
Just
I want to just let that name marinate
just
for a second. Just an absolute, just heck of a name. It's a blog published by the Institute of Religion and Democracy, which was not an organization I was terribly familiar with prior to reading the article. And I super fascinated by what the author of this article was arguing. The focus is on Gen Z, but I believe there's a caution here for all of us. And the article begins like this. In Christian circles, a major paradox is emerging: the rise of intellectualism that is, in practice, anti-intellectual. Platforms such as TikTok, Instagram, and X are flooded with theological summaries, historical claims, and moral pronouncements that are delivered with confidence, but very little accountability or accuracy. In this digital era, where every meme is a manifesto and every reel a micro-sermon, young believers are reframing Christian witness in ways that bypass traditional church structures. This isn't simply a crisis, it is a new reformation. Now, I want to pause right here. The argument being made here is that for Gen Z in particular, but I would argue it's from more than that, a lot of their understanding of Christianity is coming from reels, sort of sound bites, slick videos, charismatic figures online, rather than sort of traditional structures of faith formation. So my question for the two of you is there anything good in this? And then what is the concern you have with it?
I don't know that there's anything good. I think the problem with the anti-intellectualism that is happening, especially within the TikTok space, is facts don't matter, opinions do, and we can present anything the way that we want to, and there's zero accountability for that, and there's no dialogue back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
And now, I would prefer people read, personally, but I would take long-form interview pieces like what 60 Minutes kind of used to be before. Now it's all pretty chopped up, but to keep our attention.
So long form
discussions.
Deep, yeah. mm-hmm.
And because I think that's how our minds are shaped, through dealing with concepts that we might not agree with off the top of our head, but to really kind of lean in into that. But yeah, this idea that, well, this person on TikTok who says they're a pastor said this, it's like, okay, but what do you know about them? You know?
Yeah.
That's,
absolutely.
I don't know. That's kind of my gut reaction.
Judah, you interact with Gen Z on a regular basis. What is your reaction to this? And does it square with maybe even what you're observing?
I mean, I think in terms of what can be good coming out of it, I think that there can be good stuff coming out of it. I think that there's more access now than there's ever been to potentially good ideas, to information. And I think that the reach can be a good thing in terms of like TikTok and people using that to get their information. But I think anti-intellectualism in Christianity and Gen Z is actually one of the greatest threats to the church.
How so?
Because I think that it gives you pieces of information. Sometimes they're right, sometimes they're not. And it gives them to people who have not been taught how to research, how to ask meaningful questions, how to engage with ideas. Also, I mean, you know, social media rewards speed and bravado and what appears to be strength. And none of those things, not speed, not bravado, and not the appearance of strength, none of those are actually conducive to intellectual thought and to wrestling with ideas. And so I think that it becomes really easy to think that you're engaging in a way that is healthy when it's not.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. So the article, I left off on the phrase, it's a new reformation. Mm-hmm. It continues, which interesting parallel she draws here. We've seen this before. The printing press, credited to Johannes Gutenberg in the 1450s, revolutionized Christian communication. It enabled mass production of Bibles and theological pamphlets, fueling the Protestant Reformation by democratizing access to scripture and religious ideas. Martin Luther himself praised it as God's highest act of grace for the proclamation of God's word, but in the same vein, condemned it for its unprecedented ability to mangle the truth beyond recognition, which... it's just wild to me to go, here we are clutching our pearls over social media when hundreds of years ago, Martin Luther was concerned with the mangling of truth that would come from, wait for it, the people reading the Bible by themselves, right? Which is a totally, you know, anyway, it goes on. Today, social media plays a similar role, with the biggest factor being the algorithm's proclivity to, as you said, Judah, reward speed and engagement over spiritual depth and accuracy. The result is a culture where intellectual posturing often eclipses genuine pursuit of truth. What is intellectual posturing? And how would you guys separate that from a genuine pursuit of truth?
Intellectual posturing to me is... this idea that I feel like because I can recite something back that sounds smart, I can be seen as smart versus I'm actually confident and right in what I'm saying. The amount of people, and we get this a lot in church, and if you have sent angry emails, don't worry. We still love you. But we'll get a very strongly worded email to us on paper, you know, or in the digital space, that's this very dogmatic, I'm right, you're wrong, here's all the bad things. And then we meet up face to face to have a conversation, and it's a completely different kind of deal. Well, they don't have that keyboard warrior posturing piece anymore. And I think it's very, very similar. And online, we want to be seen as an expert, even though we don't have any qualifications of it. And the difference is, if you're really pursuing truth and you're really trying to spend deep amount of time and conveying truth, that comes from an authentic place versus a posturing place where it's just, I just want to be seen as somebody who knows something.
Well, and it's that sense, and this is sort of your words in a different, or your words differently. How do I want to appear versus how am I?
Right.
And I think that's something I'm constantly thinking about, where you go, okay, you can use certain words, you can talk in a certain kind of way to appear some way to people, but are you doing the work behind the scenes to actually be a person who is undergirded by this like deep foundation of knowledge that is gained through wisdom and study and engaging in the disciplines. In fact, article goes on, 2025 study published in Religions found that social media significantly influences Gen Z's religious identity, often replacing traditional catechesis with fragmented digital experiences. Young believers are increasingly shaped by content that mimics intellectual and spiritual engagement while bypassing its disciplines, study, context, humility, and dialogue. Mm. They can quote Augustine without reading him, critique church history without encountering its complexity, and debate doctrine without ever sitting under pastoral instruction. This isn't Christianity, but rather Christian theater, a performance of intellect without the spiritual substance to sustain it. You tell him, Lauren Knights.
Wow.
It's also about the why.
Yeah.
What is your purpose? I think intellectual posturing is, you know, I'm using, because there are some people who are very smart, like, you know, Pastor Lance, who knows his big words or whatever. But his why is to wrestle with whatever he's thinking about or teaching about. His why is not to sound cool or smart. His why is not grounded in being right for the sake of being right. But, well, let me not speak for him. I think that your why should not be grounded in this kind of pseudo pursuit of intellectualism for the sake of feeling good about yourself.
Yeah,
I think that your pursuit of, I want to get it right, I want to have information, I want to be able to disseminate information, has to be grounded in understanding how does that information impact real people, real circumstances, you know, real life. And I think that if that's not your why, pipe down.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of parallels to variety of things within our society, but I really think this idea of bypassing its disciplines is so huge. Yeah. Is that we want the results without any of the struggle.
You don't read.
You know, but we don't want the struggle part. We just want to know the answer. And we see this in kind of a parallel is within first-time home buyers, where the standards for getting into the first-time home are higher than they've ever been for folks, and as opposed to just get into the market, find what you can afford wherever that is, and live there for a few years while you build equity. Like, that used to be your first home was not your forever home. It was literally just get into the market so that you can start building enough wealth to move up into the next thing. And we're seeing a lot of first-time home buyers trying to skip all of those steps. And I also see with some of our young staff folks as well is that they're looking for the results of being in their 40s while they're still in their 20s and not realizing, like, you know, we've all been a part of this journey of this. This is part of the journey that we don't get to skip the hard parts. That's what shapes us into what goes on.
And I think we need to recognize when we skip the hard parts, we lose more than anyone.
Correct.
Not only do we become, frankly, we become sort of frauds who maybe mimic words we've heard online or memorize certain phrases or learn how to speak in a really confident manner, but we haven't done the work.
Right.
And I think most importantly, as Christians, we haven't had the character formation that comes from kind of, you know, to use Eugene Peterson's phrase, a long obedience in the same direction. The idea of getting up and being in the Word of God, being in community where I'm wrestling with ideas, not listening to some bro on the internet who yells about, well, if your pastor's saying this, he's wrong, you should listen to me. And now all of a sudden I'm like all high and mighty about it. You're like, even if internet guy is right on the facts, the way that you are being trained by that.
Right.
Is really problematic. And I think, Judah, the idea of the why is so important. It's funny, we just, you know, finished a staff training class kind of on understanding prophecy from a biblical perspective. And it was, you know, we engaged in some content, and a lot of the instructors who, you know, we were engaging their content online, they kept bringing up like, oh, well, you know, prophets you see online or in social media. I'm like, wait a second, this is a thing? Right. Here I am in my, we've got prof. I mean, I sort of vaguely knew it was a thing, but not to the extent it was. So we've got prophets on social media. There are a lot of things I don't care about. I extra double two scoops with toppings don't care about a self-appointed prophet on social media. Mm. I believe in the gift of prophecy 100%. In the same way that I really don't care about an online preacher who has no accountability in their life whatsoever. Put yourself in the context of a local church. Have the accountability of a leadership team. Like, be in a space where you are committed to a core doctrine and you're committed to a lifestyle where you're growing in those things. Like, practice your gift, not in front of a camera for the world to gawk at, but in a community where you're actually invested in what's going on and where there's accountability. Like, I am 100% in for prophets in our midst.
Right.
But this idea of going, I'm going to consume some online content, or I'm going to, like, the expression of my spiritual life is now online. But I cannot. I've been very grumpy old man in many aspects of this episode, but I think, again, I think there's a lesson in here for all of us just to go, okay, what are we looking to for our spiritual formation? Is it random stuff on the internet, or is it tried and true spiritual disciplines? Are we growing into people of character who love God with our whole hearts, who have been really truly shaped by Him and can live from the overflow of that? Yeah, Judah.
And that there's not a neutral position on that. Like, you're not, you are being formed by something.
Totally.
Like, there is, you know what I'm saying? There's not a, well, I'm just, you know, kind of in this neutral. No, something is forming you. And so because we know that we are being formed all the time, to really pay attention to what and who is forming us and forming us the most.
Yeah. Towards the end of the article, she says this. She says, if social media is becoming a battleground for truth, then Christians must respond with the full armor of God. The rise of anti-intellectualism online calls for a deeper witness that is rooted in tradition, study, and lived wisdom. Faith is a marathon marked by small, deliberate steps taken over the course of a lifetime, not a sprint designed to outpace the algorithm. While the race for attention is urgent, the pursuit of spiritual depth cannot be rushed. Gen Z is already making strides. The church must meet them there, not with spectacle, but with substance. And just a beautiful paragraph right there. And I think a reminder to us is, I just want to shift the conversation briefly to the end here of kind of like, okay, how do we sort of protect ourselves against maybe the downfall of kind of the appeal of slick online video, short, this quick thing, you know, it's highly emotional, highly engaging, whatever. How do we protect ourselves from that and, like, cultivate depth? And I think just a huge part of it is making sure there is some sort of practice in our lives where we are slowly engaging long-form content.
Yeah.
And I say that as someone who does not like to do things slow. But the spiritual discipline of slow time with God, of meditating on Scripture, of reading a lengthy book that is not, you know, blowing my mind on every page, right? Yeah. That these are formative disciplines that not only lower my anxiety, but really shape me in profound ways that I just don't think we can find when we're relying on kind of quick hitter type stuff. Anything you'd add to that, Josh?
Yeah, I think that figuring out how you consume media or content best. So I'm an auditory learner.
Yeah.
I listen way better and remember the things that I've listened to at a much deeper level than the things that I've read. And so for things that I really care about, I will listen to long form audiobooks or listen to long form interview pieces. But the key is the phrase long form.
Yeah.
If it can be done without discipline, it's probably not good enough.
That's,
and I think that's That's really important for us because the temptation is to look stuff up on ChatGPT, get that really quick, and then go for it. But it's what's crazy is that if you know a lot about a subject and then you ChatGPT their answers back and you look at them like, that's not great. That what? You know, like,
yeah.
You know, but the things that we don't know about, we just assume that they're right. Like, that's a really bad place to be. And assuming that the quick form stuff is always right is probably pretty dangerous. And so I really strongly encourage things that require you to change your schedule or require you to work around or require some sort of sacrifice is going to pay much more dividends in your life. And yes, it's not going to give you your one-liner retort to people, but that's not what we're really called to.
Yeah. Before I go to you, I just want to comment. I think what you said about knowing how kind of you learn best is super important. That maybe you do learn best watching a video. Great. Watch a lecture. Watch a long-form discussion. Right. Listen to a book. There's nothing inherently better about reading versus listening versus watching. It's about the content.
Right.
And is it inspiring deeper reflection? Judah, what would you add?
I think we need rhythms of fasting with media. Yeah. All of us, I think that has to become something that's actually not optional. I think that we should go to spaces where experts on whatever the topic congregate, right? Like the physical spaces, where are our best theologians? Where are they spending time? And then I think we have to read. I think that you got to get books and for a number of reasons. One, because it does slow you down. Mm-hmm. But two, because most books also provide follow-up trails, right? Yeah. For you to say, where did you hear this particular statistic or frame of thought is this? You know, how can I continue to kind of trace it back as far back as possible? So it's not just like there's so many things that, you know, we believe that are harmless, but that just like aren't true. I remember for so long, you know, I really thought that, you know, if I moved quickly while it was raining, I would get less wet, right? That's not true. And to be able to follow up with, you know, where did that idea come from? Who said it? What are their qualifications? I think books provide just a better roadmap for that.
Yeah. No. Well said. All right. We'll be right back.
Well, we're going to end today's episode with a little game that we like to play on here occasionally called Blessed or Stressed, where we're going to hear about a cultural phenomenon, a shift in the culture, a new product, something that's happening in the great wide world. And then we're going to decide if it makes us feel blessed or stressed. Josh, I hear you have something to share.
I do. I'm going to give you zero context and just play this ad. And then we will talk about this ad.
I'm stressed already. So when I was in college, I took one linguistics class, and I remember learning this sentence. There's a point here. The sentence was, colorless green ideas sleep furiously. And it was meant to be an example of how a sentence can have appropriate structure but have no meaning. You can break down that sentence, and it literally means nothing. The space hamster, hot air balloon.
In the ocean.
Bottom of the ocean.
In the ocean.
Okay. Judah, are you blessed or stressed by this? I need to think about this.
I am stressed, but I suppose I'm not more stressed than I was beforehand. The children already don't know how to make friends. Why ever would you give them an AI companion at a young age? Like you know, maybe this is natural selection. Have your way, Lord.
I think I agree. I am also, yes, concerned about more technology for our children. I think to the extent that it can truly encourage creation and it can truly be a co-creator and perhaps an inspirer of creativity, sure, like that's great. I'm down with that. If we're taking hot air balloons to the bottom, I'm a little stuck on that in case you can't tell.
Because when your child goes and jumps in the ocean with their little balloon from their birthday party, I don't want to hear nothing about it.
What kind of cape did he have? I don't know. He drowned because he got stuck in his cape underwater. Somebody help the poor hamster.
I will say, I think I can see how the concept could be helpful in terms of, like, I think about, you know, like if your kid is on the spectrum and sometimes they need an in-person, an in-class support person, I could see a world where, like, we could have an AI system serve as that in-class support system for somebody who needs that kind of support.
We have people doing that job now, but yes.
I know. They're not great, though. Not all of them, anyway. And also,
people need to be paid $1 million.
There's also a limit on how many people and all of that. So I could see that being available for somebody who didn't have the in-person. The other thing is I would feel more comfortable if it wasn't called a companion. Like, if you just said, hey, this is an AI tool that we're letting the children use, it's still a red flag for me, but it's the companion part.
So that is one of two different commercials that plays on iHeartRadio podcast streams.
Okay.
The other one is more inflammatory, and so I chose the simpler one.
Wisdom.
And what this thing is it's a replacement for parenting, and it's a replacement for friends. So, because it's more than just story creation, that is only one function that it has. It is literally a companion, where it is an item for your child to hold on to and interact with that item instead of interacting with their parents, instead of interacting with their friends. Imaginative play is crucial for childhood development.
Yes.
It's like, there's not one childhood development expert who would say, oh, imaginative play is completely useless. It is crucial. And it is crucial for parents to participate in that for the betterment of their child.
I have a question. You were saying that it's meant, you know, it replaces parenting and friends.
Uh-huh.
I'm just curious, is that how it's marketed? Like, is that what they would say? Like, whoever created this thing, are they saying this is supposed to replace?
No,
okay,
but it's all the roles that parents play.
Sure.
In the development of a young child's mind, parents should be participating with their kids in their imaginative play and helping them. Like, so Declan's really into writing. Mm-hmm. And so he writes all these different, like, books. Most of them are plagiarized off of other books that he's read. So we can't publish them. But But what we do is we encourage the imaginative play. We give him different ideas. We'll ask different questions. So both my wife and I are participating in him writing on these things. And the idea of farming that off to something else is horrifying.
Not
to
even
me.
Someone, something. Yeah.
Something. That's a wild
something
word.
Else. And just the... It seems to be technology built around you don't actually have to invest in your child anymore so that you can do the things that you want to do to free you up. So, like, all the marketing is like, look how wonderful your child is with this, and you don't have to do anything anymore.
Yeah.
And so it's really the alleviating of core parental responsibility. And frankly, the most fun parts of parenting is the imaginative play. It is the physical activity. It is the creating things and just enjoying those moments. Like, that's the best part of parenting in a lot of ways. And the idea that we are creating a society that's farming that out is horrifying to me. And this child is going to make an emotional connection with a digital medium, and we're going to get back into that parasocial relationships that not only do they exist, we're now fostering and encouraging.
Yep. And as I've said on this show before about kind of AI companions in general, this idea of an interaction with a thing that never really challenges you, that
Correct.
Always affirms you, that is there to help at a moment's notice, and that asks nothing of you.
Yeah.
That's super helpful if I'm trying to figure out how to fix something in my house. It is not helpful for building relationship skills.
Right.
And man, I'm now that you've described it more fully, I'm moving into the fully stressed, because I think I agree with you, Judah, that I think conceptually it could be beneficial in some ways. But when it comes to outsourcing parenting and eliminating the need for kind of that social development that comes from like dealing with other difficult humans, Yeah. Ooh-wee, that's tough. All right. Do not farm out your parenting to AI. Do not farm out your spiritual development to social media.
Farm out your chores to AI. That's what we want.
Farm out your chores to AI.
When is AI washing dishes? That's what I want to know.
Soon. Well, we appreciate you listening. Leave us a rating or review on iTunes or Spotify. If you like what you heard, it helps other people find out about the show. And we will be back next week.